Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
What is that?
I don't know.
What was that? Was that like a weird kind of, like, you did kind of like a religious, but also like a Christmas song-y thing to it?
You know, I don't know. I I've had 3 cups of coffee.
Mm, that's what that was.
And I just finished lunch.
Mm-hmm. So you're full?
So I am jolly.
Yeah, you're full of energy?
Full of energy. Ready to go.
Ready to rock and roll?
Yes.
Did you see how excited I got? And then you were like, yes.
I know. Well, because I was like, dude, should I do a song again?
You don't have to.
But then I was going to. But then I was like, no, just slow down.
Because, I mean,
slow your roll.
Slow down your roll. Mm, you could be ready to rock and roll and just be like, woo, you know, like pedal to the metal, brah.
I kind of like your excitement on that.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's inspiring.
Good. Welcome, everyone. It is season 4, first episode of the season, because it's January. Hey. January 2020.
I
expected
yawning.
Something, and
literally
you yawned. You yawned in the middle of the podcast. Especially after we went through this whole, hey, you have energy? Yay.
Yeah, that was weird.
What is going on with that?
I don't know. I
4th cup of coffee?
I think I need actually espresso is my problem.
Okay.
Yeah, this is all drip. And I am a coffee snob, so drip doesn't do.
Hmm.
But I'm also frugal, so drip does do it.
I see. Well, anyway, now that we're slightly awake, not going to yawn. Are you not going to yawn?
I'm probably going to cough, but continue.
Okay. Well, this is Podcast for Good. My name is Heather Lucas. I'm the fiscal and policy coordinator for the Washington State Combined Fund Drive, and this tired yawny person over here, what's your name?
My name is Jerrica Ferguson. I work for the Washington State Combined Fund Drive, and I handle marketing and development.
Yes, you do. I think your yawns may pass to me at some point soon.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I'll be like, why, Jerrica?
Why? Have you seen, I always think of, like, Finding Nemo of, like, I don't.
Oh, yeah.
As the whale, and mm-hmm. I very much appreciate that.
Yeah, whenever you're feeling yawny.
Mm-hmm. I do that to my niece, Ruby. I'll be like, Ruby. And she thinks it's really funny because she loves Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get amused.
Nice.
Yeah. Now you know.
Now I know. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, of course. Anytime.
Yeah. So for this particular episode, we are talking support for impoverished women, children, and families. I spoke with Anne Lachey. She's the board president for Balo USA. They are an incredible group, and we'll get to that interview. But I have a question of the podcast for you. Because this is a podcast about women, you know, and we are women.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, Jerrica Ferguson, who is your lady role model? Do you have a female role model?
I'd say my great-grandmother. Mm-hmm. Her name was Doris Christina Augusta Ekdahl, but then she got married, so it was Spiller. She is an amazing lady. No longer with us, but she is such an incredible human. I look to her because pretty much 0 to 8, I was with her, if not every day, every other day of my life. She taught me literally how to be a, like, person.
Yeah.
How to be respectful, how to be, even though maybe I don't listen all the time, but how to be quiet around adults. tie my shoe, the whole nine, but also really just understanding. The biggest thing I always pulled from her is, you know, like if you dropped a cup and you broke it?
Sure.
She'd always say, like, no reason to cry over spilt milk kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always stuck with me of, like, just let the little thing go.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that she always talked about, too, was just helping others with the smallest things, right?
Okay.
Like, it is truly, I asked her when she started getting sick, and I asked her, I was like, what's one thing in this world that you wish that more people did? And she said to just help people the small things by just taking your time to, like, help unload someone's groceries or help them write a check. Mm-hmm. Or help just to help people.
Okay.
And just the greatest woman ever. Like, just the best. She was really the woman that held the family together no matter what, you know. Great Grandma Doris, Grandma Sweetheart, like, just the best.
That was a family nickname for her? Mm-hmm. Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
What about you?
Well, mine, she kind of looks like one of my grandmas. Mm-hmm. Eleanor Roosevelt is somebody that I've always just been like, that is, like, that's a woman that I think, backbone. Like, if she didn't have a backbone before she was tested, I would be surprised.
Yeah.
Because she was in a situation where, like, she came from a political family or a family that had some kind of standing in New York, and then married into a family where it was like, okay, now we're on the political scene here.
Yeah.
So as her husband's career progressed and he got sick, then she took up the mantle for a lot of things, like fighting for impoverished women and children and families. And she was the mouthpiece and the person who went physically to places.
Oh, yeah.
On behalf of her husband, on behalf of the administration. And then she always fought for people's rights continuously. And it didn't matter to her, like, the color of their skin, the amount of money they made, where they came from. It didn't matter. So I always thought that that was something that was admirable.
That is a great person to choose, actually.
Well, like mine, I don't know her. Never got to meet her.
Yeah.
But, like, I kind of, you mean,
based on history books?
Yeah, exactly. You've got, like, an Eleanor Roosevelt in your life that you actually met.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. Oh, that's I love that. That was good.
Yeah. Do you want to cry and hold hands?
I was getting a little teary-eyed when I was talking about my grandma. No, I'm fine.
You don't want to hold hands?
No, okay. I don't want to touch. Keep your distance. Get away from me.
Hands where I can see them.
Yep.
All right, so we're going to get to the interview with Anne Lachey. She's the board president with Follow USA. Here's that interview. All right, so I'm here with Anne Lachey, the board president for Follow USA. Anne, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So can you give us a little history about Follow USA and what your organization does for the community?
Yes. So Follow USA was incorporated in 2015, and we are part of a larger global community. Mm-hmm. And so our work started in Calcutta in 2006 in India, Calcutta, India.
Okay.
And the focus of our work is in India and supporting the impoverished women and children that are living near the Howrah train station there.
Okay.
And so the story begins back in 2005 when I met, when I was volunteering in Calcutta with Mother Teresa's organization.
Okay.
And I met a woman there named Elisabetta. And she was also volunteering, and I was in one aspect, and she was working with children in an orphanage. And she went back the following year, and the orphanage had closed, and some of the children that she'd fallen in love with had been returned to their homes.
Okay.
And so she visited their homes and found their parents. The father was often away. The mother was mentally ill and couldn't care for the children, which is how they ended up in Mother Teresa's care.
Okay.
And so she started the organization, Follow.
Okay.
And started the school. And in 2015, and Elisabetta and I stayed in contact. And in 2015, we incorporated in the United States, in Washington, to support her work and the work that's happening there.
Okay. So your organization is an orphanage and a school?
We don't have an orphanage at this point. We have a school, which currently is serving 230 students, and we're hoping in the next 2 years that number will grow to about 360.
Okay.
And we have a home for endangered girls.
Okay.
And so our youngest girl in that home right now is 7, and our oldest girls are 18. Our oldest girl is 18 at this point.
Okay. And then as far as the school, is it kind of like, you know, you see movies from, like, Europe and things, Harry Potter, right? They go to school for the whole year and they live at the school. Is the school like that, or do children go home at the end of the day?
The children go home at the end of the day. So all of the children that attend the school have homes, except for, well, some of the ones that are in the Home for Endangered Girls do have homes, but they're not safe.
Okay.
But most of the children go home. They just live in such impoverished situations that they don't have access to education, and they don't have access to proper meals and nutrition. Their home lives are dismal, and the qualifications for even being admitted into the school It's a very stringent qualification process because we have hundreds of families that are applying every year, trying to get their children in. And so we really choose through a very strict process the lowest children and the lowest, most impoverished families. Okay. And that's done through home visits to each family and just finding out what those living situations are like and what their support and means of income are.
Okay. So I did some research for this podcast before we got together here, and I saw a UNICEF stat that said about 25% of children in India have no access to education. So do you have any thoughts, or, like, I'm sure with the school that you guys already are working in, like, how do you improve access in an area like that for education?
So the way we improve access is we provide the school.
You just build the school.
We really did.
Yeah.
And it started small in 2006, and it was in a little apartment in the slums of just a small little school in a little apartment, a three-room apartment. And it grew over time, but our staff has remained constant and grown as well. And the people that we hire that work in the school come from the same slums.
Okay.
So they know the community. They're invested in the community.
Yeah.
And we have slowly grown. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we left the three-bedroom apartment, and that is what became our home for endangered girls.
Okay.
So now we have seven young women living in that home with the house mother that provides for them and two of her own daughters that also came from very difficult situations. And then we moved into the school where we are now.
Okay.
And it sounds crazy, but finding a place to rent in the middle of the slums in Calcutta is extremely difficult. People are just living in the smallest areas, and many of our students come from, I visited their homes this summer, and it's not a joke.
Yeah.
They come from rooms where they are living literally 6 to 8 people in 100 square feet.
Yeah.
And there's all of the cooking is done in a common area outside.
Okay.
With maybe 6 other families, and it's done over charcoal stoves. The bathroom would be a hole in the ground that's also shared with 6 other families.
Okay.
So that's the toilet situation.
Mm-hmm.
There's minimal electricity. The floor is usually concrete, and you're fitting as many 6 to 8 people in one of these homes, as many people as possible.
Yeah.
So finding ways to reach these people has just, it's been an incredible experience in bringing these people and these children that have no opportunities.
Yeah.
So when you when you're talking about the statistics that 25% of the children don't have access to education, mainly it's because they barely have access to food.
I see.
You know,
so it's even more dire than that. Just education is one aspect that they don't have access to in their lives.
Yes, one aspect. And in theory, the country of India provides a public education for their students, but that public education is really lacking, and anyone that has any means at all is sending their children to a private school.
Okay.
If you don't have those means and you're able to send your child to a public school, the schools are still taught in the traditional languages or the native languages, and there are so many different dialects, Hindi, Bengali, and then hundreds of dialects, and the school hours are minimal.
Okay.
Some of the students that we've had that have come from other schools, they were in school for an hour a day.
Oh, wow.
That's their public education. And then after that, they would leave the school and they would go and work as a servant in someone else's home. And it could even be a home of a family member.
Yeah.
Where they're supporting, you know, they're supporting the family by working for an uncle or something like that. So it's just there's such a minimal access to education.
Yeah.
And one of the things we love about our school is it's all taught in English.
Okay.
And so it provides the students with the opportunities to continue on with their education, secondary educations, and even the university.
Yeah.
And work in a global society.
Okay.
So
So, I mean, India is very populous. Like, it's one of the most populous countries, if not the most populous on the planet. So, like, having infrastructure to build schools, it could be difficult for someone coming from the outside. But, like, the government, you would think, would have more schools and more education opportunities based off the actual population of people. But that's not the case at all.
No, it's not the case. And that infrastructure is what is so hard. It took us a year just to find the building that we're in right now.
Yeah.
And we have one floor that we have rented and that we're trying to purchase.
Okay.
And it took us a year then to renovate that building and turn it into a school. Mm-hmm. So the landlord, the owner, allowed us to rent the building for a year, pay the rent,
yeah.
and then completely tear out the walls, gut it, because it was just a mess.
Sure.
And turn it into a school. And so now that has a kitchen. It has clean sanitary bathrooms.
Okay.
It has a teacher lounge. and it has all the classes from pre-kindergarten all the way through sixth grade.
Okay.
But now we have students, because our students are getting older over the years, that mm-hmm. are, we go all the way up to 10th grade.
Oh, okay.
And so they're on the ground floor of the building,
mm-hmm.
which we've also been able to renovate part of, mm-hmm. and we have a small computer lab there, and we're hoping to even take over another section of the building that has currently a tailoring and sewing unit in it, but okay. their lease is up. Right about now.
Okay.
And so we're hoping to take over on that lease and put in a science lab and then go up to classes 11 and 12.
Oh, okay. So you can, like, fulfill the whole education from
right.
kindergarten through 12th grade.
That's right. And currently in India, graduation, and you can technically enter a university after 10th grade.
Okay.
But those standards are changing. So mm-hmm. we thought we were good to go at 10th, going up to 10th grade now,
mm-hmm.
but the standards are changing, and now universities are requiring students to have up to a 12th grade level of pre-education, okay. and they have to pass certain very stringent tests in order to even be accepted into universities. And so we feel that's our next area of growth.
Okay.
So we want to, we're in the process of buying the first floor of the building,
mm-hmm.
which is in Washington, we would say it's the second floor.
Okay.
They call the first floor, what we call the first floor, they call the ground floor.
Okay.
So we're in the process of buying that, and it's just to secure the longevity of the school, because finding somewhere in the slums is nearly impossible, and then having it be in the condition that we would need. We
sure.
spent $30,000 just renovating
mm-hmm.
that one floor.
Yeah.
And our lease is up in 8 years.
Yeah.
So it's great for 8 years, but we need something, we want something that's going to last for 100 years or more.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So as far as education for not only the kids in your school, but the families, what kind of impact has these children's getting an education have on themselves and their families and their community?
It's had an incredible impact on the families, and part of that is just educating the families as well. We
okay.
really are a, we don't just look at the child, we look at the whole community and the family.
Okay.
And so one of the other things that we do is we'll provide microloans to the families to establish small businesses, and the microloans are small, $200.
Oh, okay.
And these families are able to take that money and start little businesses. Maybe they're selling a little bite-sized meal
okay.
on a corner out of a cart that they're preparing in their dirt kitchen
mm-hmm.
on their charcoal fire.
Yeah.
But it's enough, and especially if two or three families come together, they work together on this, and over the course of the year, they'll pay back that $200, and they're feeling good about themselves, and they're feeling proud.
Yeah.
And they're learning the value of education as well, and they see that. We have parent conferences with the parents, and at first when we started this, the parents didn't show up because they didn't understand what this was
sure.
or why the school wanted to talk to them.
Yeah.
And now all the parents show up.
Nice.
Yeah, they come, they're excited about it. We have general meetings with the parents, and they have responsibilities as well.
Mm-hmm.
They are required to pay for the paper of the students
okay.
and the pencils, and they're required to keep the uniforms clean and safe.
Okay.
And I know it sounds silly to keep a uniform safe, but the when we first issued the uniforms, we noticed that many of the poor families, which is all of them, that many of the families, the children were coming back with uniforms that had been eaten by rats.
Oh, wow.
Uh-huh. And so each family has a lockbox in their home where they keep their important papers because sure. the rats run in and out. But in the lockbox in their home, they would keep their important papers. If they had any special wedding garment or family heirloom, anything, they just keep a metal lockbox.
Okay.
And so now we require that the children's uniforms are also locked in the family lockbox to protect them from sure. the rats.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, you wouldn't think that would be a thing, but...
No,
yeah.
but it is.
Yeah, it is. Wow. So as far as something like lack of education, that contributes to just this multi-generational poverty.
Mm-hmm.
So like poverty has multiple factors like environment, child marriage, nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So in the yes. region where you're working, what do you believe is the most pressing barrier for impoverished women and children?
The lack of opportunities.
Okay.
I think it's exactly what you just said.
Yeah.
That the children don't have opportunities, and especially the young girls.
Okay.
Because they are married off young,
mm-hmm.
and they're expected to move out of the house. One of the students that we have in our school, when she turned 14, she's always a very outgoing, wonderful, just gregarious student. And uh-huh. all of a sudden, she turned 14, and she got real quiet, and things changed, and the principal and director of the school were questioning her and sure. asking her what's happening. And they found out that she was being assaulted by a neighbor.
Oh, wow.
So they went out and they took care of that situation, and with their knowledge of the community, and were able to, the neighbor ran off in fear, which was good. But then a few months later, she was acting that way again. Mm-hmm. And they said, "What? You know, you're 14. Like, what's happening? The neighbor's gone. What's going on?" And she kept showing up to school with bruises.
Oh.
And after a few weeks, and she, you know, she had the stories. Oh, I fell. Oh, I tripped. Da da da.
Sure.
But after a few weeks, it turned out that her brother was beating her because he wanted her to move out of the house and go out to a village in the countryside and get married.
Yeah.
So that he could get married and bring his wife into their 100-square-foot home.
Okay.
And there wasn't any room left for Zeynep. That's her name.
Yeah.
And it's just unbelievable. And so she was one of the first girls in our home for endangered girls because
okay.
we realized, you know, she's a bright young woman.
Yeah.
She has a wonderful future ahead of her. Now she's working in the school. She's graduated. She's working in the school with the kindergarten students.
Right on.
And wants to become a teacher, wants to go back to school to be a teacher. But it's just that the women don't have the opportunities, especially mm-hmm. because the boys are the ones that traditionally take care of the families.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever the minorest opportunity is for the family, the parents give that to the boys.
Okay.
Because they're the ones that are theoretically going to be taking care of them.
Sure.
The
yeah.
girls are going to be, the sooner they get out of the house, the sooner you have to stop paying for them.
Yeah.
The sooner that burden is relieved from
yeah.
the family.
Yeah, and it's a burden. It's not a daughter.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So as far as healthcare and coverage, like, it's a major issue here, always,
mm-hmm.
right? What does healthcare look like for people that you're serving and the students and their families? What does that look like in that area?
There is very little healthcare in
mm-hmm.
the families. That's one of the things that causes so many of these families to be in the situations that they are,
mm-hmm.
is if one of the parents is sick or
yeah.
becomes injured on a job
uh-huh.
and they can't work, then they end up with either healthcare bills that they can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're losing their income that has been paying for the family and sustaining the family. So
yeah.
that is something that we actually look at carefully when we are selecting the students that come into the school. And our community also provides health care for our children.
Okay.
dental care, braces even. One of the children, they needed braces so badly, and my daughter was just there with braces this year. And this boy was so scared to get braces. And when he saw my 13-year-old daughter with braces, it finally convinced him that he could do it.
Like, she's okay.
Yeah. She's, oh, that's what it is. Okay, I can do this. So we pay for things like that. We have children. Many of the children come in with rickets. They just start right off with rickets because of malnutrition.
Sure.
So that's very common. They're fed every day at the school with vegetables. So a lot of the food is vegetarian because we serve, our population is half Hindi and half Muslim.
Okay.
And so the eating requirements are a little bit different. But we do provide vegetables every day, eggs. They love Fridays because there are extra eggs on Friday. So everybody shows up for extra eggs.
Nice.
And you see that just providing healthy food has made a big difference. But we've had children with braces on their legs, children that are mentally retarded that we serve in the school. So if we can, which with polio, children that have had polio.
Sure.
So if we can meet the needs of the children, then we do that. There are some cases in families that we meet that they're beyond our level of care.
Yeah.
But we do as much as we can. We have one student in the school who is blind. So blind and deaf, and they do well.
Yeah. And as far as children who have special needs like that, they're mixed in with the general population?
Yes.
Okay.
They're mixed in with the general population. It's a, it's just a community.
Sure.
It's a whole community, and the children watch out for each other, and the faculty, the teachers, everyone lives in the community.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at the school and you're visiting the school, and then later in the evening you're walking around the town and the area, you see the teachers, you see the students.
Yeah.
Everybody's there together.
Nice. So, as far as impoverished people worldwide, I mean, there are millions and millions, but as far as this location in India, do you think that larger agencies like, say, the World Bank, like IMF, United Nations, do they do enough in areas to help impoverished women, children, and families and communities like this? Or do they do anything at all?
I haven't seen them, any of their work happening.
Yeah. So it's mostly like, if this is the community, everything that's happening is just the people here.
Yes.
Government agencies, nothing like that really comes into play.
No. I feel like there's just so, the need is so great.
Yeah.
That it's just so hard for big businesses and corporations to get their finger into every little pocket of need.
Sure.
And from the areas that I've been in, unfortunately, I haven't seen much of their effect. So I know it can be done.
Yeah.
But I think it really takes a special person with a big heart and with caring. I hear from people all the time asking me, why should we give to people in India?
Yeah.
Why don't we take care of the homeless people in Seattle? Look around. Don't you see all the homeless people here?
Sure.
Why are you working so hard to help the homeless people in India or the people in India? So that's a question that I hear all the time.
Yeah. Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, I think we do need to help the people in Seattle, and we do need to help the people in Washington and in our state and in our community, and all of our BALO board members do, and we all support our communities here. But we also believe that we're part of a bigger society, and we're part of a global community. And when we look at the impact and the opportunities that the students and the people have in these impoverished areas, it's so much less. The opportunities are so much less. The impact that we can make with a little bit of money is so much greater than what we can make here.
Sure.
And just some of the statistics, looking at what it costs us per student to in India for a really a private school education with health care, with food, $275 a year.
For one student.
For one student.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's, if you're looking at a 180-day school year, which we have here, $1.50 a day, more or less.
Yeah.
When you look at what we pay in the state of Washington, I'm a teacher here.
Okay. Okay. So you know a little bit about about this particular aspect. Yeah.
So when we look at the state of Washington and we look at what we pay per pupil per day for 180 days,
yeah,
we're paying $66 a day on average.
Yeah.
Almost $12,000 a year per student. So you can see, by donating $275, you're changing the life of a student and their family forever.
Yeah.
And not just that family, but you educate that child and they're going to have a job.
It's a ripple effect.
It's a ripple effect. Yeah. And I can find a lot more people that are willing to donate $275 than $12,000.
It's true. Yeah, it is very true. And then, like, with the combined fund drive, if people donate just a little every paycheck, that adds up over the year.
It's huge. Mm-hmm. It makes such a big difference. I mean, even if you donate $10 a month, $10 a month, or $15 a month, you're supporting a child for 10 days of school every month, which is huge.
Yeah.
So it makes a huge difference, and the impact for your money is just enormous, and the need, honestly, is a lot greater. We don't have, well, we do have rats running around the street sometimes.
It's true.
But the need is just not what it is when you're there.
Yeah.
When I was there, and the monsoons hit, and the water is coming down, and you're walking through the streets with water up to your knees, and there are rats climbing up the sides of buildings everywhere, and the sickness and the illness, and just, it's so great. It's overwhelming.
Yeah. So we talked a little bit about money and donations, but let's say someone hears this podcast and they want to begin giving to Balo USA. Can you talk a little bit more about what donations do for your organization?
So that is how we run all of our work.
Okay.
It's all on donation. It's all through giving and charitable giving. And so not only does it support our school, it supports our Home for Endangered Girls. We also have a tailoring program where we're teaching young women sewing skills.
Okay.
And that clothes is actually being sold in Italy.
Yeah.
To make more money, which then is turned directly back into the projects in the school and the community.
Okay.
So it is all for fundraising purposes. So these girls earn a living wage. They earn a very good wage.
Okay.
They learn the skills first, then they can come back and work for Balo, produce this clothes, and earn a solid wage.
Okay.
Which they love.
Yeah.
And we also have a hairdressing program, so it helps support that. But most of that is run through volunteers that come in and donate their time. We have a woman that comes in from Italy. We have another man that comes in from Switzerland every year. And they teach the students and the teachers as well the hairdressing skills. And so our students are entering the world as stylists. So it, and the donations also support the microloans and the healthcare. So donations, that's where we're at.
Yeah, they run everything.
They run everything. They run everything.
So before we go, do you have any upcoming events or programs you'd like to highlight?
Right now, we are just focusing on purchasing that year, the first level of the school.
Okay.
And so we are hoping to have that done in March.
Okay.
And we had our big fundraisers and fundraising campaign, and we're going to continue with that until we have, it costs 100,000 euro to purchase this level of the school. And although it seems like quite a bit of money, it really is the longevity of this project.
Sure. Yeah, it'll make it last. It'll be an impact for hundreds of students for a long time.
Yes.
Hopefully 100 years, right?
At
least
100
years. Yeah. Well, Anne, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking about Balo USA with me today.
Thank you, Heather. It's been a pleasure.
All right, so that's Anne Lachey. That was an awesome interview about her organization, Balo USA. By the name alone, like, there are certain charities where you're just like, I don't know what you do.
Right. I was in that. mm-hmm. category of people that when you said you were interviewing them, I was like, what is that?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So finding out more about what it is they do with the whole concept of they were there. Anne had talked about working in India with Mother Teresa's charity and connecting with people there. So then founding the school for kids. So they've got like over 200 kids that they help, but it is definitely a ripple effect because it started with just connecting with one person and then it rippled out to we're going to connect with this community and then this school will connect with these children and these children will improve so their families will improve.
Yeah.
And then when they find like situations like Anne spoke of a girl who was in a situation where she was not as high functioning as she was before. Like something was wrong. And they found out like things were happening to her in her personal life. So she was one of the girls they put into the home for the endangered. So like that just ripples. It becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. Like they're making a huge impact.
Yeah.
It may be somewhere else in another part of the world, but it's an impact like that, the starfish story. You know the starfish story, right? Like all the starfish like float up onto the coast and onto the sand. And the kid just throws starfish back into the water. It might not save them all, but it saves that one.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, that kind of a thing. You can have a huge, huge impact without really even doing much.
It really... The small things. Well, yeah, and it takes away, in a way, from your... Like, I think a lot of people forget that when you make an action, it may not be the action that affects you,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to be the action that affects 10 years from now or 20 years from now or the kid from now that you never met.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Balo really does is they are providing these resources for a person today,
mm-hmm.
but yet this effect will affect generations and generations
Absolutely.
To come. And I think people forget that of they think that you're solving, like we'll use poverty right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're solving poverty right now. We have to solve it right now with this individual person. Well, you can't do that right away.
Yeah.
What you can do, though, is put this person in a better place so their children mm-hmm. will have better opportunities and their family members will have better opportunities. And I think, you know, we're in a short-minded place right now, and it's just so inspiring to see organizations like this understand that let's help present,
mm-hmm.
but this is going to create that ripple effect for the future.
Exactly.
And I just really do appreciate the work of people that have the forethought to do that.
And like the ripple effect, it extends into their families simply because their children are doing better mm-hmm. and like they're in this school, so they're learning, they're getting fed while they're there. They have clean clothes for their uniforms, but then also because they're part of this group in this school, their families have access to Balo, so they can do things like microloans. That was something that Anne had talked about. Microloan in India could be like $250.
Mm-hmm.
But giving $250 to a family enables them to, say, buy a food truck or start a small business.
Yeah.
So that way they can continue to build upon success.
Well, I just always think about, you know, when I had a moment that I needed to struggle, my own brother gave me $500.
Mm-hmm.
And that $500 was able to pay a bill that I didn't have the means to.
Yeah.
And it didn't put me under.
Yeah.
And I just remember that moment of, like, I, like, was so thankful, but, like, also so emotional about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that kept me afloat. And that one, like, amount was able to, so I've never been, you know, under before. And so since, and it was just this moment of, like, you know, just, I couldn't even explain just the feeling I had for it just because it kept me afloat,
mm-hmm.
like that one more month when I was struggling then.
Yeah.
And for him at the time, he was like, whatever, you know,
sure.
it's change. And I'm like, no, like, you don't understand, like,
how big of an
now
impact. Yeah.
I can, like, I'm not deciding between rent and food.
Yeah.
Like, it's truly like I can have gas to get to work. I can, you know, and I think people don't really see how big of an impact just these $250 loans or $100 loan and like these things can really do, because people that are in those positions know how to use every penny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're not ever going to see every single time what your dollar mm-hmm. what your dollar does when you give it to somebody.
Yeah.
It's impossible, because I mean, as far as like giving your dollars out to people, you touch so many people mm-hmm. without even knowing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, we have some upcoming events. Next week, we're going to wrap up some of our nomination deadlines.
On
the 10th and the 17th?
Yep, so Snohomish and King County volunteers, please get your nomination in forms by January 10th. That is the last day, so this Friday. And then Thurston County will be on the 17th. We also have statewide awards as well for local coordinators, campaign leaders, executive sponsors. So please make sure that you fill those out as well. And you can go and find that on our main site at give.wa.gov. And we have it in our scrolling feed that we have on the website that you can download some of the nomination forms and send them in, or you can also use electronic form.
Yeah, so after we get all these forms updated and get the nominations processed through, we'll be having recognition events throughout the state, definitely Thurston, King, and then we'll see where we've got to go after that. But around the corner is February 15th at LeMay Carr Museum is the Unguarded event. It was a DOC event and Bates College in conjunction. It's an art auction, and the last one happened in February 2018, so this is the second one, and we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, and also happening in February as well is our February Valentine's Day Grams. Proceeds do go to the Combined Fund Drive, and it's just a cute little way of, you know, saying hello to your coworker.
Right on. So I look forward to that. I hope you do as well.
I definitely do as well. And just so you know, because you said it like a few episodes ago, and I feel like I have to say it because it's the beginning of the year.
Okay.
I just really appreciate you doing this podcast.
So I've got that for episode one. I'll expect something like this on episode two. Yep. Ka, 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 ka. I don't know why I'm doing evil
yeah,
laugh
you're doing
and evil,
evil
hands.
Yeah, you're doing a lot of evil
why?
Stuff when
why?
I said something really nice.
Yeah. That's because I'm uncomfortable now.
Oh.
That's what that is.
Okay.
I don't know what to do with my hands.
I don't know what to do.
Well, I do know what to do. We're going to end the podcast.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day, everybody.